What is Demystifying Research? Hosted by me, Kelly Harris.
And me, Catherine Hoyt.
Demystifying Research is a space where we dialogue on training, careers, and all things research.
Everything from is research right for me to thinking about applications, mentorship, which research degree is right for me, handling failure and rejection, CVs versus resumes, and funding. This is a space where we engage in discussions around the questions we all have or have had when considering a career in research and science.
As clinician scientists, we seek to answer questions and address issues that aren't clearly addressed in more formal spaces, things that weren't addressed in our clinical training, questions that we may not know how or where to begin to seek answers. This is not a space only for scientists and researchers, but for anyone who may be interested in science and research. We're so glad you've joined us. Let's dive in.
So I guess I'll get started with sharing what the topic is about. Today, we're talking about different parts of a PhD and what the different components of doing a PhD is like, and how that can be helpful potentially for prospective students who are considering doing a PhD, what to look at in different programs, and what they can expect to see during their journey in becoming a research scientist. So with that in mind, we're welcoming Erin Foster today, who is the director of the Rehabilitation and Participation Science Program. Would you like to introduce yourself, Erin?
Sure. Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here. My name is Erin Foster, and I am an associate professor in occupational therapy and neurology and psychiatry at WashU Med School. And as Catherine said, the director of our Rehabilitation and Participation Science, or RAPS PhD program.
That sounds busy.
It is a little bit, but it's good. I like to stay on my toes.
You want to give just like a brief like summary of what your research focus is?
Sure. So my research focuses on functional cognition. So how we use and integrate our, you know, thinking and memory and processing skills in everyday life in complex environments. You know, how we use our cognition to support the performance of everyday activities and roles. And I am interested in understanding the nature of functional cognition, how we can best assess it, and then how we can develop interventions to support it in people who have functional cognitive deficits. And most of my work focuses on, the primary focus of my work is on functional cognition in neurodegenerative diseases, specifically Parkinson's disease. And that being said, I also look at lots of other aspects of Parkinson's disease, and also have sort of a more recent interest or line of research related to diversity and representation in Parkinson's disease research, and starting to sort of get into more community engaged research efforts. How's that?
Sounds good to me. Thanks for sharing.
Yeah.
I'm excited about this like new path of your research that it's taking.
So am I. And I'm excited that I have you guys as, you know, people who've been doing this work. Sometimes I feel a little bit like an imposter, but I'm glad that I know I have lots of resources and colleagues who are experts in the area that I can, you know, learn from.
Cool. Well, I'll jump in with the next question. And I think just thinking about both your, you know, kind of your own educational journey and then, your current role as director of the PhD program, can you talk a little bit about the kind of typical structure of a PhD program? So, you know, what are the different pieces, components, coursework, qualifying exams, dissertation, things like that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think you hit on sort of what I think of as like the three main, like, formal components of a PhD program or degree. And so that would be the coursework, or like some sort of structured learning or foundational phase that usually occurs at the beginning of a PhD program. And so again, as I said, that often includes like required coursework. It could also include electives. And in some programs, it might involve exploration of the program's laboratories, or like rotations through the different laboratories that are available to you within the program. And so you kind of had that structured, you know, learning foundational phase, and then there's some sort of hurdle that you have to overcome to sort of prove that you've got the foundation and you're ready to progress to the next level or qualify. And so this is what, you know, we often refer to as a qualifying exam or quals or sometime a comprehensive exam or comps. And so then, you know, once you've qualified, you can move on to your dissertation phase, which involves independent but mentored development and then conducting and reporting, usually on some sort of original research project. So those are like the three main components or phases or milestones that students work through in a PhD program.
So, quick question. So you talked about qualifying exams or comprehensive exams. Is that like a traditional exam, or can it take different formats?
Yeah, so it can definitely take different formats. So it can be like an actual exam that tests the knowledge that you've gained from your foundational coursework. It could be an exam whereby the student is expected to extend the knowledge that they've gained from their coursework into their own research ideas or area. In a lot of programs, it can also take the form of like a research proposal or grant, where, you know, the student again has taken what they've learned, maybe identified gaps or problems, and then developed a new research project or idea, to address those issues. And sometimes qualifying exams are written, like essay style exams. Sometimes there's an oral component where they might have to present or defend their ideas or answer questions from a committee. And sometimes they, depending on the program, can involve both a written and an oral component. So those are kind of the ones that I, the different sorts of formats that I know of.
Yeah, excellent.
Well,
Thanks. I think I've seen programs too where there's like kind of a criteria component, right? Like, have you published a
ah,
manuscript? Have you,
okay.
yeah. And were you first or second author, that kind of thing?
Yeah, that's interesting. I know that we don't have that in our program. We do have milestones or sort of expectations that, you know, where we sort of expect students to be or what we have expected them to do, you know, year one, year two, semester one of their program. And sometimes that involves, you know, presentations or authorships of manuscripts, but it's not necessarily a formal requirement of our program. But I could see how that may be in other programs.
Just so we're all on the same page, could you talk about that coursework just for a moment? Like what, how long is it? Yeah, just if you could talk about the coursework.
Yeah, how that works. So, I mean, again, I think there are differences across different programs. And so you guys might be able to share what you know about other programs. But, you know, usually there's sort of this initial more structured phase. And oftentimes it, you know, requires coursework or for the student to fulfill a certain number of credits worth of coursework. And in some programs, like the way that our program works, there are actually four required, we call them core courses. And every student in our program has to take those four courses. They're spread over 2 years. And then, so that's the requirement. And that's what our qualifying exam is based off of, the knowledge from those courses. But then within that, they also have requirements of different content or knowledge that they need to gain from coursework that they can get, you know, across the university. So they need to take, you know, an intermediate and an advanced statistics course. They need to take some sort of research design and methods course. They need to take a course on ethics. And so I think that, you know, the specific requirements probably vary across programs, like whether there are, you know, specific name courses that students have to take versus they just have to take a certain number of credits within certain areas. But it's kind of a typical beginning to the program just to make sure that the students have, you know, the foundation of knowledge in their field or discipline, and that they are getting maybe like the research skills that they need to support their dissertation and then also their future work. I also mentioned that sort of in that beginning phase, some programs, you know, as a part of the curriculum, have the opportunity first, or actually, it's like a required part of the curriculum, is that students do rotations in the research labs of the program. And so then that helps them decide what lab they ultimately want to enter for their dissertation work. So that might be a part of sort of that initial required coursework. And then one other component that I know is required in our program, and actually across our university, is this mentored teaching or mentored professional experience, whereby a student engages in teaching or professional work, again, as preparation for their future role. So that can be another component of like the required coursework for a program.
So, like serving as a TA for a course or that kind of thing.
Yeah, so doing some so like a mentored teaching experience might involve, you know, doing some structured learning about teaching, you know, the theory and practice of teaching and learning, and then actually doing some sort of mentored teaching, whether it be a TA or a teaching assistant or an AI, I think that's what we call them now. But different programs vary. So it could involve even being a course master for a course, depending on the program. And then, for example, if you're getting some sort of a professional PhD, it might this mentored professional experience might involve actually doing some mentored clinical work. Like I think that happens in neuropsychology PhD programs.
I think Mario had to do that.
Yeah.
Not the clinical part, but the like be a course director.
Be a course director. Yeah. I mean, there's a whole range of possibilities within what the teaching experience entails. In our program, it's typically an assistant instructor. But it can be more or less.
Think we had an option. I did both at like an assistantship, which was in part to like fund the PhD, right? Like you're also doing that to cover funding, but then I was also able to design and teach a course. So it's interesting. It sounds like there's a wide range. And so, but you know, I'm hearing like some kind of core buckets in terms of curriculum related content, qualifying exams of some sort or some kind of qualifying metric. And then the dissertation,
Yes.
which is like the big culminating experience, right? And I think that's, I feel like it's what we hear most about when we think about PhDs, right? You know, what was someone's, whoever's dissertation on? Can you talk a little bit about that kind of culminating component?
Yeah, I mean, so you're right. The dissertation, I think, is like the big thing that the student does on, you know, on their own with mentorship. And it's really sort of the demonstration that they can integrate or synthesize knowledge and evidence from their field to, you know, again, identify important gaps or problems that need to be addressed, and then develop question potential solutions or questions to ask to either address or better understand something that we need to understand better, and develop a scientifically rigorous process for answering those questions, and then, you know, bring that project to completion, you know, analyze your results and disseminate and report them in, you know, understandable ways, I guess. So it's sort of the culmination of what your coursework was preparing you for, and then also, you know, as you're working on your project, you're also gaining more skills in research, you're gaining more knowledge, you're generating evidence that then might, you know, could serve as a launching pad for your career as a PhD student. And so typically dissertations, you know, it's a process. You might start on the beginning part of your dissertation. If you're already in your lab, you might start on that even a little bit before you take your qualifying exams. But then after the qualifying exam, during that dissertation portion of your program, you know, it might last 2, 3 years or more in some cases.
A couple of times I've kind of hit on what sounds like to me an important distinction, and I think we've talked about this in other episodes, with this idea that you can come into a PhD program like directly into someone's lab where you have communicated with that person as part of your application process. And, you know, there's an agreement that you're entering and that's who you're going to work with. But then it's not, you know, there's a lot of folks who don't come in, or programs even that operate where you don't come into a lab, you come into the program. And just listening to you talk about kind of going through different people's labs to kind of get a sense of what folks do. And so I don't know if you'd want to share any more about just those distinctions, that there are different models, if you will.
I do think that's a big difference in programs. And I don't know if I, you know, like I don't know if certain models are more common in certain fields or disciplines. But you know, what research lab you're going to be in or what mentor you're going to work in is really like the first big thing that kind of constrains or narrows the focus of your research topic, of your dissertation. And so, you know, that step, again, as Kelly just, as you just mentioned, can happen, you know, at multiple different times. So in our program, for example, students enter our program already matched with a mentor or a lab. So that means that before even applying to our program, you know, they've done their research. They've read up, or ideally, they've read up on the different mentors and their work. They've identified some that pique their interest. They've hopefully corresponded with the mentor about their interests and goals and potential fit, and maybe gotten verbal agreement from that mentor that they would be willing to take them if they're accepted into the program. And so when they apply to the program, they list, you know, potential mentors that they'd want to work with. And so they're starting out in the program with some general idea or area for their research. And then, but in other programs, students are there for a while, maybe a couple years before like officially entering a lab. And again, there may be formal lab rotations built into the curriculum. So like as a part of the curriculum, they might spend, you know, a different, you know, each semester working in a different mentor's lab. That they usually pick or are matched with based on, you know, some general idea of like interests. Or there might be other just, I don't know, less formal ways for them to try out or get a sense of the different labs and mentors' research before they choose and are placed in lab. And I would say that even in those, you know, those situations, it still requires a conversation with that mentor about your interests and goals and what's going on with their work to make sure that it is a good fit before you're placed in that lab.
So that makes me think, sorry, Erin.
Yeah, no,
One thing that
that's good.
a common question that I've gotten from people interested in pursuing a PhD or just starting to have that conversation, is like, how do you develop your research question? And I think feeling some insecurity and just general like unease of, do you have to start your PhD already knowing your research question? How do you come up with a research question? Do I have to have one all on my own? How does that happen? Could you
Yeah.
talk, you talked through that a little bit, but how certain do potential PhD candidates need to be about what they want to be like looking into during their PhD program? For some reason, that didn't sound like a word to me for a second.
What you're talking about. I know
Yeah,
what you're
like
trying to
what should they
say.
be doing? How much should they know before they start?
Right. So I would say really, like, you don't have, like, I do think that that is something that stresses students out, and it can put a lot of pressure on students to feel like they need to know exactly what they want to do when they start. But I think that's, you know, a fallacy. I think it's also slightly mentor dependent. There might be some mentors that are really looking for students that know exactly what they want to do and how to do it. And so, you know, there's sort of, or whatever that this student wants to do, like fits perfectly within this mentor's lab, and they got a project figured out right off the bat. I mean, that could happen. I'd say in general, it really is a process that takes place over years, you know, as over those first couple years, you're developing your knowledge, you're understanding the science and the evidence base in the field. Like you need to take time to understand that first. Before then, you can figure out, what we know and don't know about, a specific research area or topic or population or approach or method. And that it's sort of that organic process of helping you sort of home in on your specific research interests and questions. And then along the way, you're also addressing the skills and figuring out what skills you need to learn so that you can address the question. But, I would say that it helps to have like a sense of a general population that you're in. It helps you find a good fit with a lab or mentor to maybe have a sense of like a general population that you're interested in, or like kids with sickle cell disease, or a topic like functional cognition, or an approach, like community engaged research. That kind of helps, and I feel like that becomes apparent pretty early on. But what specifically you're going to ask or determine about that general area is really developed, throughout your time in the program. And that's what you take your classes for, and that's what you get guidance from your mentor about. And I think that's what a part of getting a PhD is for. It sort of guides you through that process of identifying and developing questions and then being able to answer them in scientifically rigorous ways. So you're not expected to know exactly what you want to do or how to do it from the beginning. Did I answer your question there?
Yeah.
Okay.
So no, I like how you talked about how that kind of initial time is really important to just understand the field. And the other thing I was thinking about is like, regardless of whether you come into a lab or not, one of the questions I was going to ask you is, you've said mentorship and like, what does that look like at different phases of the process? But I guess I'm just thinking like the time to build a relationship with this person that's helping to guide your career seems really critical. And figuring out how to work together and how, understanding the work that they do beyond what you've read online or, the limited conversations you may have had on the front end, seems like it'd be really important, right? I mean, this is one that is influential in a really kind of important time, if you as you're completing a PhD. So yeah, I'm just wondering if you can talk about, what does mentorship look like at different parts of the process, and what are things that students should be thinking about as they're cultivating that kind of relationship?
Yeah, that's a really good question and point and question. And that can be hard because oftentimes students are they're attracted to a mentor or a lab because of the science. Something about what that person is doing is interesting to them. It's the topic. But you also have to remember to think beyond the science to this idea of like personal fit, the lab culture, the mentorship style, the personality fit, because you're going to be there for a while, and this person has a lot of sway over your development, and so that stuff is going to be important for your overall experience. And sometimes it's really hard to know about that, especially if you're like matching into a lab before you even get to the program. And so I think that one way to sort of at least give you some leg up on ensuring good fit is, again, making sure that you talk to that mentor in addition, before making the decision. And in addition to asking questions about the science and talking about your science, also make sure that you're asking questions about sort of mentorship style. What does mentorship look like? And being aware of like what sort of mentorship and supervision works best for you so that you can assess that fit. I also think a really good thing to do is to talk to other students or trainees that have worked with that mentor. So to me, this can be even more revealing than talking to the mentor themselves about like what they think their lab style or culture is. It really helps to talk to other students who have been through it and to get a sense of what the culture might be and what the mentorship style is. And then I think something else that's nice to remember is that, you know, it's not only your primary research mentor or advisor who's there to support your development. In most programs that I'm aware of, you have a committee of advisors or mentors that help monitor and support your progress as you go through the program. So you don't need to get everything from that one person. It's really a team sport. And so you can also, you know, as you're there, you know, if you find that something is missing in your relationship with your primary mentor, you know, as they're there and you start to get to know other people or you have this committee of advisors, you can seek out what you need from different people. Yeah. So that's kind of like the big picture, but I feel like you asked other questions in there too, that I didn't quite get at.
I think that's such an important point though you just mentioned. And I think it's something that is excellent for students to work on when they're students in a PhD program, but it's something that I have learned as a mentee in my, you know, throughout my career beyond the PhD, right. As a junior faculty member, like that mentors are not, you don't want just one.
Right.
You should always have a network of mentors. You should always have, you know, one person can't serve all of your needs, just like as people, like, you know, we should all be thinking about mentors in different areas. So for example, I have a mentor, somebody that I consider my like teaching mentor when it comes to kind of pedagogical things. That's who I go to versus, you know, mentors in my research areas and just other kind of, you know, we go to different people, even like in your friend circle, you probably talk to different people about different things. And I think of mentors in much the same way that you want to have several that you are really kind of maximizing your own growth by ensuring that you're interacting with different people that can help kind of help you grow in different ways. So I don't know. I just thought that was an important point that you mentioned.
Yeah, that's so true. I mean, and the people that you'll be working with in your PhD program may become, you know, sort of your lifelong, part of your lifelong mentorship network. And it's like, you know, you're doing something new here. So you have to pull expertise and experience from like multiple different sources. Like if you were just going to do the same thing as somebody else, then maybe you'd be fine with just that one mentor, but you're not. You're doing something different. And so again, you need, you know, you're integrating new things. And so you also have to integrate like your sources of support as well. And it's not only the science, but then as you alluded to, there's like professional development, there's career development. There's people who can help you network with, you know, other important people. So,
yeah. The other thing I think I was thinking about is that, you know, like, yeah, you work with a mentor, but not to be that person, right? To like have a related line of work that is your own. And I think, you know, as students, we can, I don't know if it's like a confidence thing or what, but like, we feel like we can, you know, we're limited to kind of this narrow scope when really it's about figuring out the kind of who you are in this research space. So that's cool. The other thing I guess I was just thinking is like, what are the things that students should be asking or considering as they kind of consider these different models? Like, you know, understanding when you identify that committee, or is that a committee that changes over time? Like, you know, are these questions that students should be thinking about on the front end? Understanding how that, you know, how a program perhaps operates. What are the models they use?
Yeah. So in terms of like programmatic operations in our program, the student is required to, I believe, develop their, we call it a RAC, their research advisory committee, at least some form of committee by the end of their first year. And they submit a form, you know, with their names on it and that they've signed. and so, you know, but then that committee can change or morph over time based on the student's needs. So what I've seen, you know, people can come on, people can fall off. What I've seen is that the committee typically starts small. It's like your primary mentor and maybe just another person, maybe a senior scientist in the program who can also, you know, help guide general development. And then as the students, specific research topics or areas become a little more solidified, then they might call more people in who might have expertise in a specific, say you want to include a qualitative component in your, research project. You might bring in somebody with expertise in that area. Or say you want to study a specific population, you might bring in, somebody with expertise in that area. So that sort of formal research advisory committee can change over time. And typically, again, I've seen it, I see it grow. But yeah, I guess it's never too early to think about who the people are around you that might be able to kind of help you out, and just start thinking about kind of cultivating relationships with them. And I also think that's something that your mentor can help you with as well, as identify other people who might, because I think most mentors, like I myself, know personally, what my strengths and weaknesses are, or what my limitations are. And like, if I don't know something about a specific topic or approach or field, I'm not gonna pretend like I, know it and be the only person, that has access to my PhD student. So I would much rather connect them with somebody who, can be, can do a better job at mentoring them in that area. So I don't know if that answered your question, but basically the point is it's never too early to start developing relationships and think about who are the people you can surround yourself with to support your work. And you may also have things to contribute to the relationship as well. So that's also, a good way to think about it, is that it's not only you receiving or taking support from people, but it can be reciprocal.
I think that's a really good point. It's never too early and it can be reciprocal. So I feel like that is a muscle that I needed to practice during my PhD training, like just reaching out to people. Even though it gave me a lot of anxiety, I didn't think that I necessarily had anything to offer. But it could be that perhaps I have a perspective or training that that other person doesn't have, that they would love me to be included on a paper and provide feedback, or maybe I can give ideas about measurement, or like there's different things that I think there totally can be a win-win, and that can be fabulous. And it is important to reach out and grow that team, because you never know who's going to be like a great match. Maybe you'll meet with one person and it won't work out, but you'll meet with somebody else and it'll be fantastic.
Yeah, I agree. Or maybe it'll
But
work out for a small period of time and then you move on. But yeah, never too early, also never too late. As Kelly said, we get mentorship throughout our life.
yeah.
I like that. The comment you made about like it's sort of a muscle. It's your like this is your time as a PhD student to practice doing these sorts of things,
Yeah.
to step outside of your comfort zone in a relatively low stakes situation, and get used to it, because it's what you're going to be
People
doing.
give like some slack too to PhD trainees if they're like, oh, that was a really awkward email, or like they shouldn't have sent this quite yet, but they're like, oh, well, they're like in their first year of their PhD. It's fine. Like,
Yeah, for sure. And most people, I think, are happy to help. Like support young up and coming investigators.
yeah, totally. A lot of people are. I think we all are trying to figure out how to find that harmony between our work and our lives too. So finding that harmony could be a so people still say no, even if they are happy to mentor. Just throwing that out there, it doesn't mean you're a bad person or not capable. Some people just don't have time.
Agree. Yeah, don't take it personally. But again, that's a part of life as
And a
that
no is like
academician.
might just mean that there's somebody else better that you need to, or that's equally
Right.
good that you need to find, and there is
Someone's
more than
going
one
on.
person that can do whatever that thing is you're looking for, most likely.
Right. They might have a lot of things on their plate that they may not have the time right then, or it just might mean there's someone else. But what I'm hearing, kind of culminating from all of this conversation, thinking about like the coursework that's selected and how the qualifying exams are, and like finding a mentor that aligns with your interests enough to help you develop a research question that hopefully is of interest to you. But all of it is kind of purposeful, unlike perhaps other degree programs or maybe your undergraduate education, where you might take a lot of classes in a lot of different topic areas. Everything in from what you've said, it seems to me, or like everything is really focused on this one goal of creating a scientist, is kind of how I'm thinking about it. Like the coursework is for you to learn this specific thing. Everything goes to that. Is there anything else that's part of a PhD training that kind of contributes to that professional development? Do you think? We've talked about those other things, but anything else you can think of?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there are other pieces to it, but I think all of it, again, contributes to, you know, be at least in our program, being a scientist, but then also being, you know, a professional or like a member of the academy. And so, you know, there are like soft skill, you know, you need your science skills, but you also need your soft skills to get on in, you know, this increasingly complex and collaborative environments where you're dealing with multiple different types of people and stakeholders and having to manage your time while, you know, trying to advance your career. So there are lots of other things that PhD students do, but again, still intentional and purposeful. So, you know, there are, like, for example, there are all kinds of, at least at WashU, university resources that students can take advantage of. So here at WashU, there are, for example, tons of talks and seminars about all the topics. I mean, I could spend all my time going to talks and seminars, or like even every day a week, a talk or a seminar about like a specific topic. And they can be about science as well as general professional and career development. So I would say, you know, and it's a way to sort of to learn about more things. It can help you develop new ideas. It's also a good way to just get out there and meet people, see who's out there. So I would say join those mailing lists, monitor, you know, the calendars for those learning opportunities. There's also sort of, you know, like extracurricular, but still school related activities, like serving on graduate student committees, or joining student associations, or taking leadership roles in those sorts of organizations, which is a good way, you know, to gain an understanding of how like academia or these different institutions operate, as well as to network and then also maybe develop your leadership skills. And then of course there's, you know, presenting and networking at conferences and symposia, both at, you know, at the university level and the national level, and that's to help you practice communicating about your science, again, meeting with people in the field. So I think these are other sorts of opportunities that PhD students take advantage of to sort of grow their skill set in different ways, their professional and career development types of skills. Thoughts on that?
I mean, no, I feel like you just touched on a bunch of things. I think I was thinking about some of the like additional things, like you might attend talks or webinars, or I like that you added that getting involved in student organizations. That was a big part of my time during PhD training.
Yeah, I thought about you when I was saying that, because you did that and it really helped you sort of get the lay of the land and
yeah,
like
totally.
Know people. And I can tell, like, develop certain skills that serve you well. And I don't know.
Understand how the institution works.
Yeah,
big thing.
Which I think is huge. Many of us come into academic institutions as faculty and don't have that kind of keen understanding of how they work. So being in those rooms to listen has got to be critical. I was also thinking, Erin, when you were talking, that like we recently now kind of informally require our students to attend an outside talk. So it's like built into one of their classes where that's the expectation. There's time built in for the, you know, just to go experience things outside of the program, right?
Right.
Because we can find ourselves kind of just in our one little space and not, you know, really experiencing so much of the other things and opportunities and resources that exist at the institution broadly.
I mean, there's so many resources and opportunities. It would be a shame, you know, to not take advantage of that while you're here and you have the time and the energy. As a PhD student.
That's I think a key one, and the energy, time.
Yeah.
Energy. It's amazing to me. I like had no idea how faculty members spent their time, and now being on the other side of it, I'm like, oh wow, I had so much time before.
Yeah. I know.
I thought I was busy before.
Oh, this is really great. Thanks so much for joining us to talk about this, Erin. I think, you know, despite us all having obtained a PhD and gone through a program, right, and done many of these things, I think your perspective as director of a program and kind of having that nuanced view is really helpful. And so it was really great. I learned some things today.
Thank you for joining us today. Check out our other episodes to hear more. You can find the first season on YouTube under Washington University Program and Occupational Therapies channel under the First Fridays for OT Research playlist.
And more episodes of Demystifying Research linked under the Research tab on the Washington University OT webpage at ot.wustl.edu. That's ot.wustl.edu. Send us your ideas for future episodes at demystifyingresearch@wustl.edu.